you see here that I'm from Portland State University, but like many students, I also have a full-time job with the Office for Oregon Health Policy and Research. And I was an emergency department social worker for 5 years, and if you know anything about health policy, you know that the place you want to, if you want to observe what happens to people when there's changes in policy, work in an emergency department, because they'll change the law and 2 days later they'll walk through the door. And so I spent years of just sitting down with people and hearing about how their life is impacted by their inability to access health care, by when they accessed health care, the inability of the health care system to meet all of their needs, help them get prescriptions, transportation. And that kind of drove me into my career, which is doing health policy. So I'm here today to talk to you about a process that we went through for the Office of Health Policy and Research to try to help policymakers in Oregon understand how much health care a family in Oregon can afford. And I'm a little embarrassed because this is not rocket science. And you know, when we talk about our presentations today all being evidence-based practice, it's, you know, not super methodologically astounding. But I have to say, of all the work I've done for the Office of Health Policy and Research in 2 years and done lots of research and lots of studies, this is the work that really captured the imaginations and the hearts of the policymakers. They were blown away. And so we'll go through this, and if you guys are social workers or you work in public health, you're probably like, meh. Yeah, of course, who doesn't know that? Well, the truth is, and we're going to talk about this, but the people who don't know that are the policymakers. Do I reach over here to... Okay. Ah, beautiful. So, the federal poverty level. If you guys do any kind of practice, a lot of what you do is probably driven by the federal poverty level. It tells you who qualifies for what. It tells policymakers who's poor in our country. And this started with a woman named Molly Orshansky and the Orshansky poverty thresholds. And this was during the war on poverty, and she was a health economist working for the Social Security Administration, and she was tasked with helping evaluate the war on poverty. Is it helping? You know, are our policies making people less poor? So what she did is she took how much it costs to eat, because in those days, this is in the 60s, costs of food actually were kind of the big costs that a family faced. It wasn't like today where transportation and housing or childcare have the same kind of weight. So they looked at 4 food budgets, and they looked at the very cheapest, and they said, okay, well, a family spends about a third of their income on food. So if we take the lowest cost that a family could spend on food and still be nutritionally solid, and we multiply it by 3, that's poverty. And that's where the federal poverty level came from, and that's what we use today. It is adjusted by the Consumer Price Index every year. That's why we have every year a new number. And Department of Health and Human Services uses it in all of their means-tested programs to say who qualifies and who doesn't qualify for programs. In Oregon, we have an SCHIP program. So everyone here know what SCHIP is. It's a Medicaid expansion program for kids who make a little bit more than poverty. And we go up to 185% of the federal poverty level. And the governor, because we have about 117,000 uninsured children in Oregon, wanted to create a program that would allow all kids, regardless of their income, to qualify for some kind of health insurance product that their parents could purchase and get subsidized help for if it was unaffordable for them. And he asked the Medicaid Advisory Committee, and I'm the director of the Medicaid Advisory Committee in Oregon, which is just a policy advising body, to come up with some policy for this. He's like, well, who's going to be eligible? How much are they going to pay? What is the program going to look like? And the Medicaid Advisory Committee asked the Office of Health Policy and Research, where I work, to develop, basically to tell them what is affordable. Show us the data. Tell us how much families can afford. Now, the stakes with this are high, because we know from other research that if you build a program, and it can be a wonderful program, but people can't afford it, they won't come. It's not like, you know, that old saying, if you build it, they will come. We know that they don't always come. And there's lots of literature to support that. We have an example of that in Oregon with our Family Health and Insurance Assistance Program, that families can get insurance through their employer if a barrier to taking that insurance has been money. And so basically they get some subsidization from the state. If the state's subsidizing at like 95%, there's great take up. We, you know, lots and lots of people want it. But when you start getting down to 75%, there's fewer and fewer people. 50%, almost nobody. 25%, you know, nobody. So what we found is if we're paying for most of it, we can get people. But when you start asking low-income people to make a significant contribution, unless they have a child that's really, really sick, unless they have a family member that's really, really sick, chances are they will not enroll. And that's supported by national literature that has looked at employer take-up or how many people take employer-sponsored insurance and looked at other family health insurance subsidy kind of programs like we have in Oregon. And there's an equity issue as well because, and I repeated this over and over again when we were doing this policy making, the program would not be a success if the people we enrolled were the upper middle income people and the people who we didn't enroll were the people who were poor, too poor to qualify for, or not poor enough to qualify for Medicaid, but too poor to pay for health insurance. That there's a serious equity issue here. And to me, I don't think we would have a successful program if we have this kind of hollow where the lower income of the higher lower income fell through. How'd I say that? That was pretty roundabout. So the quest was to try to get an idea of if you're a family living in Oregon, different place parts of Oregon, and you have so many wage earners and so many kids and, you know, this kind of expenses, how much health care could you afford to pay in terms of premiums on a monthly basis? How much could you afford to pay if a child got sick and they needed, you know, to go and see a doctor in terms of co-payments, or if they were in the hospital in terms of co-insurance? And our approach was to utilize data on family budgets, so to look at basically how much it costs to live in Oregon in different parts of Oregon, and then trying to figure out by federal poverty level, how much do they have to pay for health insurance. That was the approach we took. And I'm going to tell you some other approaches that came that happened later as Massachusetts started doing their affordability work. There were some more publications with different approaches. But our guiding assumptions were this. One, existing data is good data. We didn't have any money to do any kind of research for this, and so we had to kind of look at what we could do. And we had a choice to make. We could look at, like, MEPS data or the Medical Expenditure Panel Survey data, which looks at how much people spend, report spending on housing, and maybe we could aggregate it to the local level. I mean, we could aggregate to the state level. It's unclear whether we'd be able to tell what's happening in rural parts of Oregon. Or we could look at standards that have been established by the government that represent kind of minimal standards for different expenses. And we decided to take that approach, and I'll talk more about that in a minute. And one thing I have to say here is we did not assume that healthcare was discretionary income. We know for some families, if you have a member of your household that's ill, it's far from discretionary. You will pay for their healthcare before you pay for housing, before you pay for food. But if you're a low-income family and you're, you know, all your kids are in one room and you're living in a neighborhood that's dangerous and you're, you know, you can't afford to pay for their soccer shoes, you can't afford to take them anywhere nice, when you get a couple extra dollars, you're not necessarily wanting to put that towards a monthly premium for something that may or may not happen. So insurance is a little bit of an esoteric idea when you're just getting by. So we wanted to balance both of those awarenesses. Our data sources came from the Economic Policy Institute, and this is part of my learning objective for you, is for you to be aware that this resource exists. At the time that we were doing this work, it was in early 2005 or 2006, and the most up-to-date budget calculator they had on the website was 2004, but I looked recently and they have 2005 now. And we adjusted that, because we were doing this in 2006, we adjusted that by the inflation rate of 6.83%, which is what the Consumer Price Index showed as the inflation rate for the time spanning our the 2 years that we used for the federal poverty limits of 2006. And, of course, we used what the federal poverty level that's established by the United States. I'm going to run through these really quickly because all of this information is available on the EPI website, the Economic Policy Institute website. My goal is that you can go do this at home. This is one of those things that it is safe to do at home if you want to understand affordability in your region. And other people have done it at home, and it's kind of taken on. It's really exciting. So the housing was based on HUD's recommendations for basically decent, structurally safe housing, and they made some assumptions. They assumed that if you had one or two kids that you would only have a two-bedroom apartment, And that if you had three kids, you would only have a three-bedroom apartment. So you have some, you know, if you actually work in the field, you're like, yeah, what if you have two teenage kids and they're opposite gender? You don't really want them sharing a room. But for our case, it's an impossibility. You only have, they're all sharing rooms. So food, it was based on the second to lowest low-income, like nutritionally okay standards of diet. And it assumes that you're not going out to eat. Maybe occasionally, but very rarely, you have to prepare your food at home. Transportation with standard IRS cost per mile that included basic taking care of your car, getting where you're going, vehicle registration. The budget assumed that you had one car per family, so there were no two-car families, and it only assumed non-social trips. So they were very rigorous. You could go to church on Sunday. You could go to work, and one adult can run errands, but that's it. So you're not doing it. It's just assuming that you're going only a couple miles to work. Child care, this is the one that to me was the most unrealistic. But they did base it on child care centers in both urban and rural locations, but it assumed a four-year-old in a one-child family and one four-year-old in a school-age child and when you have more than one child. The problem with that, of course, is that not everybody has a four-year-old or a school-aged child, and I myself have a one-and-a-half-year-old, and the budget that they have here for child care is just so low compared to what it actually costs for our area. Taxes, pretty standard. They did assume all family was renters, that all families work and all income is from work, and that all the adults take care advantage of all child tax credits. Calculations of other expenses, about 27% of your housing and food costs, and that is pretty consistent with national data on what people actually spend. So this is where everything that we didn't talk about before for a family budget was put. Whether you need cleaning supplies, if you're going to pay, you know, your child's soccer fees or anything else. We're going to talk about more because you might be going, well, does the family have any credit card debt? Do they have any savings? And the answer is, for these purposes, no. So we're making very conservative budget decisions. So for those of you who are not from Portland, Oregon, Portland and Oregon and Vancouver, Washington are neighbors by a bridge. And so even though we're different states, sometimes we're kind of considered one rural area because it's just a bus ride over a bridge and you're in Vancouver. We made up budgets for like four different rural, and as a part of this process, for like four different rural areas in Oregon, and then this urban area, and then the Eugene Springfield urban area. But I didn't think that you guys needed to be drugged through all that. So I'm just giving you some examples here of what this looks like. And you can do this for your state. You can go to the Economic Policy Institute. You can create budgets for your state. You can plug it in with the federal poverty level, and this is the kind of stuff that you get. So the Economic Policy Institute will do all those calculations for you, and they'll say, well, for Portland area, and you have one parent, one child, this is how much those expenses are, and that equals $2,656 a month. Remember, these are all very conservative estimates of cost of living. So you take that, and you plug that in with the federal poverty level of how much you were supposed, if you're at the federal poverty level for one adult and one child. As you can see, at 100% of the federal poverty level, you're $1,556 short of making your monthly budget to live in the Portland-Vancouver area. 133 we put because that's an eligibility point that's used a lot for different kinds of federal programs. I'm not sure why. But so for one parent, one child living in the Portland area, only when they hit 250% of federal poverty level do they have any money that they could use to put towards their health care for their child. And again, we're assuming that they have no credit card debt. We're assuming they're not buying anything fun. There's no cable. There's no, you know, let's all go to the movie on Saturday night. We didn't put any of that into their budget. This is minimal housing, minimal food, minimal transportation, minimal expenses. And Portland's kind of an expensive place to live. So rural Oregon, of course, money goes a little bit farther when you live in a rural area. One parent, one child. They have some discretionary money between 150% and 200% of federal poverty level. So at 200%, they can afford $30 per month. Assuming that they don't make any other changes in their lifestyle now that they have the extra $30. When you start talking about two parents and one child, that's a little bit more advantaged situation if you have two wage earners and one child. So they start to have discretionary income at about 250% of federal poverty level, and they've got a pretty substantial amount at that point. They've got 396, but at 200%, they're still below. This is rural Oregon, two parents, one child. Now, as you can see, between 150% to 200%, they start to have some discretionary income. We made hundreds of these for policymakers that we were willing to show them, that told them their specific area. If they wanted to know about Corvallis, Oregon, we would go with our Corvallis, Oregon budgets and charts. But we even took it further than that, and I'll get to there in a second. So this is when it starts to get hard, of course, when you have one parent and two kids. And now, you know, many of these families could have one parent and three kids or one parent and four kids. But as you can see, at 250%, they've got a little bit, but they've went all the way to 200% in the hole. Then rural Oregon, one parent, two children. So we just created this presentation to kind of show people, you know, when you talk about federal poverty level, policymakers are like, they don't really know what it means. They assume that it's straightforward. You're at poverty level, you're poor. If you're above poverty level, you're not poor. So this was shocking to them. They were like, what? 200% of federal poverty level and you don't have lots of money? That's twice the poverty level. I mean, it blew them away. They just sat there stunned. And I just kind of thought, well, you know, of course everybody knows this. We made very conservative decisions. No debt, no interest rates. We said that they, you know, no good housing. They weren't living in nice neighborhoods. And other considerations that were conservative is that we didn't say that these families, as they went up, could change their living. So when we were talking about someone at 300% of federal poverty level, and now we see that they have $600 extra every month. Now, realistically, you would think, well, what would you do? Maybe you'd get a bigger apartment. You know, maybe you would get another car so that you don't have one person taking the bus to work. Maybe you would take a family vacation, try to have some kind of standard of living. Maybe you would have credit card debt that you could now pay. Maybe you would actually even save money. But we didn't include any of that, nor did we include any catastrophic expenses that may have occurred. So we took these numbers to the Medicaid Advisory Committee. We did this process, and then we took them on the road. We went all over Oregon to public meetings where we showed people the budgets that we had created for their area, and we said, what do you think? And they said, you guys are really conservative. It costs a lot more to live here than that. And how can you assume that I have a four-year-old when I actually have two kids under four and my child care is, you know, $2,000 a month? And we heard that, and we heard that, and we heard that. And we went back to the Medicaid Advisory Committee and say, we said, okay, these are conservative. People feel like you should, you know, take that into account. So based on the evidence and the public input, the MAC recommended to the governor no cost sharing at all above 200% of federal poverty level for the Healthy Kids Plan. So no premiums, no co-payments, no co-insurance. Sliding scale premiums up to 350% of federal poverty level. They felt like people needed some form of help until they made that amount of money. And predictable cost sharing through premiums versus exposing families to unpredictable cost sharing that can happen if you get a really sick child and you're paying like co-insurance, like a 20% co-insurance for every visit. How am I doing on time? A minute. Okay. Da-da-da-da-da. So the legislative process, it went from the Medicaid Advisory Committee to the legislature. We produced a brief of this information to them. They had multiple bills, and they ended up with a bill that went up to 300% of federal poverty level subsidies, and they stuck with the no cost sharing below 200%. And this was funded by a tobacco tax that, because of weird Oregon law, would have to go into the Constitution. And this was voted on yesterday by the citizens of Oregon, and I'm sorry to say that it was defeated 60% to 40%. The tobacco lobby put $12 million into Portland, or into Oregon, against the Healthy Kids Plan, which broke a state record when it hit $4 million. So as you can, it just shattered our records. And it's hard sell to say a tobacco tax in the Constitution, but it was the only way that lawmakers could pass it. So sorry to tell you that today. I was really hoping I could come in today and be like, and we won, and kids are going to get health care. And no, sorry. What worked? It worked to be concrete. It worked to show people what federal poverty level is and what it costs to live. It helped to adjust for geography. It helped to be conservative, and it helped to have the public input. Nobody was fighting us over the budgets. We didn't have to go there because they would look at it and look at themselves and be like, well, I spend more than that on my housing, and I spend more than that on my child care, and I spend more than that on food. So we didn't have to have that kind of discussion. There's lots of limitations. It's prescriptive over what people do. You know, some people may not have child care. They might use the person next door for $300, and so for that it's not very accurate. And there's several other approaches that have came out since Massachusetts started doing their plan, and most of it relies on expenditure data. Most of it is done by health economists, and it's a very different approach. I'm sorry, I'm going over. I'll try to be really quick. It's a very different approach because it tends to look at what people spend and doesn't really take into account that people make very, very difficult decisions and that you may be doing child care that you don't even feel comfortable with, but that's the only child care you have, and that we should really think of some standard for what we think people should pay for decent housing or what we think they should pay for decent child care or decent food. And then they also look at data, look at who takes up private insurance, and they use that. So they'll say, well, it's affordable if people actually buy it. But I would argue that the people who buy it may buy it because they have to, because they have a family member that's ill, and that the people who don't buy it are the people that we have so many uninsured. And so I am concerned with setting affordability standards based on whether or not people currently take it up, because the people who don't may have very valid reasons for not doing that. Here we go, though. We have health reform still happening in Oregon, and I think it's possible that we'll be putting an individual mandate like Massachusetts has forward to the 2009 legislature, and affordability becomes even more important if you're talking about making people have health insurance. And Massachusetts' approach has been to say, well, if you can't afford it, we'll let you opt out. But I feel like that's an equity issue. I think that, you know, again, if you get all of your middle class and upper class folks insured, and you have all your really poor people insured through your Medicaid, but the people who aren't insured are your people that are not poor enough for Medicaid but too poor for anything else, then you really have a significant equity issue. And the Healthy Oregon Act of 2007 is the work that we're doing right now to try to create a comprehensive reform in Oregon, and we will be looking at this all over again. So thank you very much for your time.